So I'll just give a bit of introduction to Mary. She's a senior lecturer in English at the University of Southampton. She's also taught at Middlesex University and the Open University. Her particular interests are 19th century literature, obviously, and culture, with a specialism in book history. Yeah. Particular research interests are the history of reading and the publication and circulation of Victorian and Edwardian popular texts. That's really interesting.
Thank you.
And together with Barry Sloan, Dr. Barry Sloan, who came to talk to us 2 weeks ago, they're currently co-editing a volume of essays entitled Rural and Urban Relationships in the 19th Century, Uneasy Neighbours. As we would expect, Mary is the author of numerous publications, book sections, articles, and I think your most recent book published this year, or to be published this year, is Charles Dickens's Great Expectations, A Cultural Life, 1860-2012. Is that right? Is it ready?
Yeah, it just came out last week.
Did it? Excellent. Okay. And also, Mary was awarded a prestigious Arts and Humanities Research Council grant, I think, to work on the work that is a result of.
Correct, yeah. Yeah.
So, you're very, very welcome. Thank you for coming to talk to us today.
Thank you. For that. Yes, that's yours, yeah. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to thank the University of Hull, Jackie especially, Catherine Cockin, who sadly can't be here today because she's freezing in the States. She says it's snowy over there. But she invited me, and it's a very great pleasure to be here. And thanks also to Gordon for meeting me and showing me the way to the library this morning, without which I would have been a bit lost. My aim today is to take my cue from the title of Elizabeth Gaskell's famous novel from 1854 to 55, North and South. And I want to take a look at this novel, but also some of the other novels from the mid-Victorian period, and think about them in terms of how they view northern and southern ways of life, and how they sort of see themselves in relation to each other. There's a strong tradition in both regions, of course, of defining ourselves against other parts of the country. And being, as I'm sure you can tell by my accent, a northeasterner by birth and upbringing who has settled in the south, I have become personally increasingly fascinated by how this rivalry and this very strong sense of proud regional identity came about and what its history is. I now live in the south and have lived there for over 20 years, but I still get called blunt. It's assumed I'm thick-skinned and a bit humourless. I get quite, upset by that one. Because to southern ears, I have a northern accent. Although when I come back north, my family thinks I've lost it, which is another story. We know this idea of a northern stereotype is only partially true at best. Probably a bit nonsensical, really. Every bit as stereotypical as the idea of the sort of sophisticated, urbane, more European, friendly South, or Southern Softy, as my Northern family call me. This is a relationship and a set of stereotypes that are very old indeed and have a very complicated history. But since, as Jackie said, I'm actually a 19th century literature and book history specialist, I've become particularly interested in how these relationships have manifested themselves. And actually, they sort of burgeoned in that period in the 19th century for some really interesting reasons. In that period, what is called the Condition of England novel of the 1840s and 50s emerged. These novels by Benjamin Disraeli, Sybil, 1845, by Elizabeth Gaskell, of course, Mary Barton, A Tale of Manchester Life, 1848, by Dickens, The Famous Hard Times, and again by Gaskell, North and South, appeared in the years immediately following Frederick Engel's report, Condition of the Working Class in England, in 1844, which exposed the lives of the country's newly industrialised urban centres. Rural poverty was not new, of course, certainly not in the 19th century. The case of the Tolpuddle Martyrs in Dorset, not far from where I now live, in the late 30s, drew attention to increasing rural poverty, partly caused really by the mechanisation of farming. But after the Poor Law Amendment Act of 1834, poverty, particularly urban poverty really hit the headlines. I mean, headlines in a newspaper way, but also in a kind of a more popular vernacular way, in a whole new manner. Poverty itself has a history, and the handling of poverty. Since the 17th century, Britain's poor had been handled within parishes. The new Act, the Poor Law Amendment Act of 1834, wiped away local rights to deal with poor people as the parish saw fit, and implemented an infamous system, the workhouse, designed really to punish the poor for things that were deemed to be their fault. Oh, the idea was making not working so unattractive that you'd rather, you know, do anything than go to the workhouse. The truth, of course, was this was not going to help. The truth was very different. With a rising population, particularly in urban areas, and a very volatile market for the goods created by industrial methods, meant repeated cycles, which we're familiar with today, I think, of boom and bust. And these had terrible effects on the working classes. Add to this machine-related injury, diseases caused by overcrowding, malnutrition, the exploitation of children, and the undeniable fact that more and more people were moving to the cities away from the country in search of work. And you have a new national catastrophe. The dates of these novels are very significant. The 1851 census showed that for the first time in history, more people lived in towns in Britain than in the countryside. This was a real tipping point. Condition of England novels, they're called, but they almost invariably take the North-South divide as their theme, usually centering on the contrast, of course, between northern factory towns, characterized as brutal and poisonous and a bit pestilent, and idyllic country living in the south, or sophisticated metropolitan southern lifestyles. And these sort of southern lifestyles are characterized as rather blind to the conditions of northerners. These are people who don't have to think where their china or their cotton or their linen comes from, because they're safely removed from Staffordshire, from the Midlands, from the north, where these things are made. That sense of a widening gulf between north and south, poor and rich, a gulf so wide that Disraeli subtitled his novel The Two Nations, he meant the poor and the rich, characterises most of the novels in this period. This is one of the things that most interests me in my current work. While the idea of a North-South opposition is not new, it did achieve new currency in this period. By the time Gaskell wrote North and South in 1855, she didn't need a subtitle. Everybody knew what that meant. It meant two nations. It meant we have a real problem in this country. North and South, by this time, had become a metaphor for inequality and a seemingly unbridgeable national divide. It was Engels' work really which helped to spark this debate, the condition of the working class in England, and which then it went on to inspire the Communist Manifesto. Engels' work was an exposé of Manchester factory life, of course, sparked by his own experience of working in the factories in Lancashire, owned by his parents, where they sent him ostensibly to keep him out of trouble, and it really didn't work. He just got in more trouble. Engels aimed to raise political awareness through his reporting. But the novels are doing something a bit different, and that's really where I want to turn next. Awareness raising is one of their aims. They're not just out to entertain us, to tell us a nice little story about, kind of bucolic South and tough Northerners. They're actually out to educate us, to raise our consciousness as readers. But they also seek to solve the political problems and their terrible human cost in a peaceful way. Marx and Engels wanted revolution. These novelists advocated its opposite. The problems were not confined to Britain. There were revolutions sweeping across Europe in 1848, and they almost led to revolution in Britain as the Chartists, grew in strength. Chartists, arguably Britain's first organised labour movement with a very proud stronghold in the north. There's a deep and quite long-lasting nervousness amongst the middle and upper classes as Chartism begins to develop and gain more and more members and more currency as a movement with a united voice. I think middle and upper classes, middle and upper class anxiety are exactly what our novelists today that I'm talking about are trying to address. These novelists have largely a middle class audience, and they're very conscious of that anxiety and they're very keen not to make it worse. So each of them tries to find a different solution to the idea of revolution as bringing sweeping change. The Chartists are not just political activists, though. They're a very interesting link between the work of Engels and the work of our novelists. They're not just protesters demanding genuine reform, which would extend the Reform Act of 1832 enough to give working people a vote, and which, of course, attacked the Poor Law Amendment Act, which drove people into the workhouses. Chartists were also often writers, too, and they saw writing, particularly poetry, as a key way to reach hearts and minds. So a means, in other words, every bit as important as demonstrating. And I think that's a really key thing about the Chartists. Their most successful organ was a paper called The Northern Star and Leeds Advertiser. That was its second part of its title. It carried news and debates, of course, debates about Chartist rights, the demands of working people for equality. It was full of very, very intelligent, reasoned and very passionate debates, not just on a national level, but also on an international level. And it had an astonishing circulation for this period. 50,000 copies a week is a very good circulation at this time. Only Dickens could really match and better that circulation in this period. Unusually also for periodicals in this period, the Northern Star published as many as 8 different editions every week, each geared towards a different region of its members in the country. This was a paper that celebrated as well as recognised regional difference. What bound these people together was their class, their shared need for some kind of sweeping reform that would improve working class lives. There were Chartists in the East Midlands, the Black Country and South Wales, as well as the industrial north. And as I've said, writing, not just journalism, but creative writing, was a key thing for these this newspaper. The Star printed poetry, not only by famous writers, inspirational national writers like Shelley or Shakespeare, but also original poetry by working class writers from across all these regions. Here's an image of the largest Chartist demonstration, really, on Kennington Common, where the Chartists took their charter, the People's Charter, to Westminster and presented it. It was turned back, and Chartism really disappeared very much, fell apart after this moment of extreme failure. It was a very peaceful demonstration, however, it's important to say. The Chartists were very... They had a lot of arguments about how peaceful they really ought to be, but their overriding concern was really what we would now call non-violent non-cooperation. They sought to be peaceful because they thought that was the best way to show that they weren't a threat. They were simply human beings with rights. So this is them demonstrating, thousands of them, but in the end quite fruitlessly, on Kennington Common. And here's an image of one of their poems. This appeared in the Star in November 1848. taking equal place among all the national and international news. It's not like the Star as a newspaper has a page devoted just to poetry. There are poems scattered throughout it, so you couldn't read the international news without coming across a poem, an inspiring poem of some sort. The two things are just as important to Chartism. Almost every issue carried poetry of this type. Much of it, as I've said, original and by working class writers. This one is signed Puppet Show. I don't know if anybody knows anything about this pseudonym or what it means. I'd be glad to hear about it. I haven't been able to find anything out about it yet. The poem itself, I won't read it out for time purposes, but this is a scathing attack, actually, on the last king of France, Louis-Philippe I, who was renowned for his devotion to the good life, really, and his sort of unconcern for the poor. A month after this, he was to be deposed, in fact, by revolution. And the Chartists were really sort of heavily and passionately involved in and supportive of these struggles across Europe, although they disagreed about the extent of bloodshed they were willing to kind of be involved in, and in the end tried to keep it absent from their own demonstrations in Britain. Nonetheless, writing, clearly creative as well as factual, is seen in this period as a key way in which minds could be changed and common ground established. Cue our novels of the 1850s. Aimed at the middle classes, tiptoeing onto the national stage with good intentions, but very different styles and very different results. They're all pleading understanding and awareness of working class problems. But they needed to walk a fine and delicate line between awareness raising and appeasement of middle class consciences. Because if one irritated or alienated one's book buying public, no good could be done at all. One's book would remain on the bookseller's shelves. It's worth saying, as a book historian, I have to add this because I find it interesting. Novels were too expensive for most working people in this period, and literacy rates not yet at even in the 90th percentile by this time. While many of the novels I've mentioned began life in serial form, particularly Gaskell and, of course, Dickens's novels, and serials were worth sort of were retailed at around 3 old pence. Novelists also wanted to make sales in volume form because that kept their income up. They didn't get a great deal out of the serial versions. So the stories they told, the ways in which they told them, had to finally appease and please and not annoy the middle-class volume book buying public. So I think that's a little book history fact. Disraeli, the first of my novelists, already a Tory MP by the late 1830s, and in 1868, of course, to become Prime Minister. David Cameron's favourite Prime Minister, I read the other day. Don't know why, but one nationism, I think, is the answer to that, really. Says a lot to me, I don't know. Disraeli posited a simple solution to the problem of North and South and rich and poor in his novel Sybil. Everyone simply needed to stop living in the modern industrial world and return to an old feudal system under the benevolent paternalism of the aristocracy, so-called one nationism, a phrase which I think Cameron has picked up on, although he wouldn't dare kind of put it back into the Disraeli kind of model, I don't think. By contrast, Elizabeth Gaskell's first foray into working middle-class relations in Mary Barton showed us a very grim picture of slum and factory life and stressed that it needed to be sorted out. But it did so in rather a strange way, I think. This is Gaskell, this earlier 1848 novel, is Gaskell feeling her way, I think, around the problem. Rather than address the problem of urban poverty and the sort of lack of poor relief, proper poor relief for factory workers, this novel decided instead to issue stern warnings about the effects of poverty on working class morals. They may be starving, but the real risk to them was their morality. When suffering in slack times, for example, working class women like the heroine Mary Barton herself were portrayed as being at risk, risk of being tempted out of poverty by unscrupulous middle-class young men. The cost, of course, being the young woman's virtue. And working-class men, like the central male character John Barton, Mary's father, were portrayed as being tempted to join groups like the Chartists. The middle classes are so nervous about the Chartists that it would not behoove any novelist really to take their side in this period, uncategorically. John Barton enters a slippery slope to ruin when he joins a union. He's persuaded by that union to murder the young factory owner's son, Harry Carson, who also happens to be the seducer of Mary. Unsuccessful seducer of Mary, because she gets rescued by our novelist in time, of course. But here, trade unionism and cross-class extramarital sex are presented as the worst thing that could possibly happen. And their prevalence amongst the poor, or their risk amongst the poor, should I say, is blamed on poverty, not on politics or on class prejudice. Gaskell was a Unitarian minister's wife. Born in London, lived most of her young life in Cheshire and much of her married life in industrialised Manchester before dying suddenly in Hampshire while she was trying to buy a house to live in when she moved back south. Serve her right, I say. So, quite widely travelled as she was no stranger to North-South relations. Yet her rather unsatisfactory solution to the problem of northern urban poverty in Mary Barton indicates a more widespread inability to find an answer. Nobody really has the answer, I think, at this time. Gaskell's solution in this early novel is to marry her heroine Mary off to a worthy man of her own class, Jem Wilson, and send them overseas to start a new life in the fresh air of Canada. I'll return in a moment, I'll return in a moment to her later solution in North and South, which I think more sophisticated in some ways, though perhaps guilty of a fair amount of romanticisation of its own. In between Gaskell's two novels, Dickens, there he is, everybody knows him, of course. Dickens's Hard Times takes a different tack. It appeared in his own weekly journal, Household Words, between April the 1st and 12th of August, 1854. As this cover shows, Household Words, price threepence a week, ninepence for the monthly bound version, was a very densely printed journal. It's not illustrated. There are no sort of ways into this text for those who might be semi-literate. So actually, what it required was something Dickens was very good at, vivid word painting. Here is Dickens's description of his fictionalised northern town, which we now know as Preston. He calls it Coketown. In the hardest working part of Coketown, in the innermost fortifications of that ugly citadel, where nature was as strongly bricked out as killing airs and gases were bricked in, at the heart of the labyrinth of narrow courts upon courts and close streets upon streets, which had come into existence piecemeal, every piece in a violent hurry for some one man's purpose, and the whole an unnatural family, shouldering and trampling and pressing one another to death, in the last close nook of this great exhausted receiver, where the chimneys, for want of air to make a draught, were built in an immense variety of stunted and crooked shapes, as though every house put out a sign of the kind of people who might be expected to born in it, lived a certain Stephen Blackpool, 40 years of age. I think this passage makes it clear that the people are moulded by their environment. And Stephen Blackpool is indeed bent and thin and broken. Defeated, really. Unable to marry the love of his life because he's already married to a violent drunkard and he can't afford a divorce because of the divorce laws in that period. Dickens uses Stephen, really, to show us the ground-down, hopeless working classes being despised and ignored by the factory owners. But he also has a sideswipe here at the divorce laws, by the way, very much on his mind as his own marriage disintegrated. In the same town, lift the children of the famous utilitarian, Mr. Gradgrind, being crushed by the weight of an education in bare facts and not allowed to play or draw or express any creative thoughts at all. "In this life, we want nothing but facts, sir, nothing but facts," Gradgrind thunders at every opportunity. And the result of this grim philosophy, his wife is a nervous wreck. His daughter, little Louisa, sits staring into the nursery fire after school, wondering what life can have left for her. And finally, when she grows up, she ends up morally compromised and separated from her much older husband. And Gradgrind's son, Tom, ends up a thief and a liar on the run for his life. The novel only permits happiness to the simple horse trainer's daughter, Sissy Jupe, raised in the circus, who is incapable of learning facts but knows how to have fun. She alone gets to grow up healthy, marry, have children, and settle the condition of England question. Everyone else in this book is doomed. It's one of Dickens's angriest, shortest, most polemical, and perhaps relatedly, least successful novels.